The opinions voiced on this program are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, or financial advisor prior to investing. Securities and investment advisory services are offered through Jenios Wealth Management Incorporated, a member of FINRA SIPC.
The Feds actually did raise rates, and the market seems to have shrugged it off. Could the spell be broken? Well, we're going to talk about today. It's what really matters, and we start now. And welcome to What Really Matters. This is your host, Peter McClellan, with Jeff Hyback of Strategic Equity Management. Hey, Jeff, what do you make of this? You know, for so many years, it seems like when the Feds have not been in, you know, totally accommodative mode, the market seems to have really gotten spooked. And the Feds raised rates this week, and yet, you know, yeah, the market sold off a little bit, but I don't know. Could it be that the spell's broken? What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think it was really refreshing. You know, for me, I included on Tuesday in our blog one of my favorite charts that kind of showed the market reaction to the Fed's changes in quantitative easing one and two and Operation Twist and when they tapered. And you know, we saw again every time the market had big drops, it was when the Fed wasn't doing quantitative easing. And in fact, even earlier this year, they were done with quantitative easing. But back in February, Janet Yellen started talking about the Fed looking at negative interest rates. Then she started talking about the idea of running a high-pressure economy, which basically meant they would let inflation kind of get overheated to see how much economic growth that would spark. And so the market's been relying on the Fed really up until the election. And then since then, they've ignored everything. And even during the Fed's press conference, she was pressed on this high-pressure economy thing, and she backed off on that. And you know, the Fed puts out what they call these dot plots, which is essentially a summary of their economic projections. And included in there, you could see that the Fed is now, instead of looking at two rate hikes in 2017, they think there's going to be three of them, which wasn't priced into the market. And yeah, it sold off some on Wednesday, but then it came right back on Thursday and then had a little bit of a bump on the road on Friday. But that was more related to some news out of China and them seizing an underwater drone in international waters. But that, you know, all in all, you know, the market handled the prospects of higher rates okay. And I should say, mm-hmm. The stock market handled the prospect. The bond market panicked, and we saw the bond market, you know, we saw Treasury yields just in a couple of days move almost 20 basis points again, which is 0.2%. And we're just the last, you know, really since Trump was elected, we've seen an astronomical jump in yields that it's hard to find another period in our history where we've seen them rise that much in that short amount of time.
And again, that's primarily on fear of inflation, right?
Yeah, exactly, because all of Trump's policies are highly inflationary. And then you start you know, adding in, you know, one of the charts I put in this week showed the reserve balances held by the Federal Reserve and how they reacted to the various quantitative easing programs. And one thing that I always thought was interesting was when the Fed was doing quantitative easing and giving the banks more money, they actually got tighter with that money. So they wouldn't put any money to work. It wasn't until the Fed would back off those policies that the banks would start lending some of that money out and getting it into circulation. And so you combine, we have still about $600 or $800 billion from QE3 that has not been put to work. And then you add in Trump's policies of spending a whole lot of money, and you have the prospect of a whole lot of money flooding into the financial system. And when that happens, typically you have prices going up significantly, which then erodes the value of your coupon payments you get on your bond. So that makes them less valuable.
So where at this point? I know we were at 2.5. Where's the 10-year Treasury at this point?
It went back over 2.6 again today.
2.6. Okay. Wow. And the rate you're talking about that the Fed's raised with the federal funds lending rate, that's the rate between the banks, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's a very short-term rate. the the Fed charges for lending money, you know, say, and I always use, especially this time of year, the It's a Wonderful Life scenario where they're having that run on the bank. Well, you know, banks don't keep all their money in their vaults. So if when all their debit card and credit card transactions clear and, you know, people that still write checks, those clear in the morning and they say, oh, shoot, we don't have enough money to cover them, they can borrow money from the Federal Reserve, and that's the rate they charge. So it's a very short-term rate. The free market actually controls the longer-term rate. And, you know, they see a whole lot, you know, different perception of what's happening than the Federal Reserve does, obviously.
Well, now, let me ask you this, though. Hasn't the goal of the Feds for the longest time been to see some inflation come back into the picture where the economy is heating up enough where there'd be some inflation? Because for a while, it was, wasn't there a big concern over deflation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason being is that when you see prices going down constantly as a consumer, you're less likely to spend money because you're going to be able to get it at a lower price down the road. And the counter holds true if you know you see something you're in the market to buy, whether it's you know a refrigerator or groceries or anything else, you want to buy it soon soon as you can before prices go up. And that's it's been a while. I think it was back in 2008 when we saw oil and gasoline prices skyrocketing. I remember almost stopping every day just to keep the tank filled up because you knew, the oil prices would keep being reflected in gas prices. And so that's kind of the concept of an overall economy is you want to keep that tank filled up as quickly as possible. And, then that sparks some economic growth and, supposedly then that filters down to everybody else and all as well. But the fear is that if prices start going up too much, then you start to put the squeeze on consumers and businesses that are kind of living on the edge.
Right. And then housing too could slow down at some point, right? I mean, in terms of the, if it becomes too expensive, don't have a mortgage if rates go too high. But yet, don't we have a long way to go before the rates would get ridiculous for, a 15-year, 30-year mortgage?
We really do, but it's all relative of, if somebody could afford a house at 3% barely, if rates go up to 4%, then they can't. The more rates go up, the more you limit who can borrow money. On the other side of the equation, though, if you have banks getting more willing to lend at higher interest rates, they might relax some of their standards. So that's something I've argued for at least the last 6 years with you, Peter, is, we need higher interest rates to get the banks interested in actually wanting to make loans. We've done exercises at your seminars and seminars across the country. And, for whatever reason, a reasonable person believes if you're a banker and you're lending money for 30 years on an asset that's very hard to repossess, you need to get somewhere between 6 and 7% interest. So when rates are at 3%, there's really not much motivation to lend money. And, just today, 1 month doesn't make a trend, but we saw both building permits and housing starts plummet in November, and that's when rates just barely started going up. So that'll be something, as you know, we watch very closely as far as economic indicator.
Right. And I know you do quite a bit in the area of working with debt instruments. The high yield bond is an area, and not to get specifics in there, but I read an article the other day, and I hadn't thought of this, but it said something about as it comes to interest rate movements upward, that I wasn't quite sure what they were getting at. There was an idea that the high yield is an area that wouldn't be as sensitive to an interest rate increase as other bonds might be. And first of all, is that true? And if it is, why is that true?
Yeah, absolutely.
You just finished saying a minute ago that it's companies and people who are living on the edge that suddenly are out of luck if rates get to a place where it makes whatever they were going to do too expensive for their budget. But what were we going to say about the high yield?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And that's kind of where you want the Goldilocks scenario for high yield bonds. What we saw following the election was high yield selling off right along with treasury bonds. Every bond, any income instrument, whether it was real estate or utilities or bonds, just got crushed following the election. And that was a little bit baffling to me, but like everything at Strategic Equity, I don't question it. The data said to sell, so we sold pretty much all of our high-yield bond holdings,
right,
as well as emerging markets and real estate and anything interest rate sensitive we got out of.
Okay.
But then over the last, I'd say, 3 weeks, high yields started acting more like you would expect high yields in this environment. Because you got to take a step back and say, well, why has the stock market rallied so much? And the stock market's rallied because they expect very strong economic growth. Well, if you think of high yield bonds, they're the riskiest of all companies that are borrowing money. That means they need strong economic growth in order to make their payments. And I've always used high yield bonds as a good indicator of the overall direction of the economy, not so much of interest rates. And so over the last several weeks, we've seen high yields start to act like you want. Economic growth is expected to be strong. So they've been rallying a little bit. But then you'll get to that point, as you just mentioned, where if interest rates go up too fast, then economic growth will start to be a little bit more in question. And then you might start to see high yield bonds selling off once again.
Okay. Okay. So anyway, you're if anybody who has listened to this podcast before knows, Jeff has a website at semtradersblog.com, semtradersblog.com. And Jeff, you have a 2017 projection in there. Maybe I know no people listening can't see it, but tell us about that. What it means to you put a variety of scenarios in there about what has to happen, and just it doesn't seem to me that you're very bullish on the year ahead. Maybe I'm wrong, but from putting this chart out, I'd have to say that you're somewhat less than optimistic about the market's ability to continue to perhaps defy gravity, if that's what it's doing, right?
Yeah, I mean, what I wanted to do was just do a simple two-dimensional analysis of what we might see from the market next year, because at the end of the year, it comes down to how much did companies earn and how much were investors willing to pay for those earnings. So what was the PE ratio? And so from a starting point here, we only have a couple weeks left in the year. We can see that right now the stock market is trading 22 times operating earnings, and we don't have time to go into it today, but it's not the real earnings, but operating earnings that we're looking at. And if you look at just historical valuations, that's about one standard deviation above the long-term average, which puts us in what we would call overvalued territory. So we might see stocks remain overvalued all of next year. If the prospects for, say, 2018 are high, stocks can remain overvalued. You know, an overvalued market doesn't mean you have to sell right away. It just means it's a little bit risky, or a lot of bit risky, depending on the scenario. But then I looked at what are analysts expecting for earnings in 2017, and I about fell out of my chair. And that, you know, is saying something, since I have a stand-up desk. But we, right now, analysts are expecting 20% growth in earnings. Keeping in mind, over the long run, earnings grow about the rate of the overall economic growth, so you add in some inflation in there. And so at best, we're looking at people saying GDP growth in 2017 might be 4%, so let's add in 3% for inflation. So 7% is what you should expect. But somehow, some way, I don't know if it's because tax cuts are going to come about or growth is just going to be so fantastic, and whatever it is, analysts expect about almost three times what normal earnings growth should be. But if that happens, goodness gracious, we're going to be looking at a 27% jump in the stock market next year.
If that happens.
If that happens.
Now, analysts that are looking like that, they're not the typically not the ones issuing debt. They're not the ones who are nervous about interest rates and balance sheets. They're more along the lines of cheerleading, would you say, in terms of, you know, their view of the markets?
Yeah, I mean, stock analysts have notoriously been wrong, and it's something we've done in our blog time and again, and I'm sure we're going to be doing it again in January. They tend to be very over-optimistic in their assessment of what's going to happen with the earnings growth rate. And so what we're looking at, you know, I gave some other scenarios. I said, okay, well, what if we get you know, maybe more tepid earnings growth. Maybe we still do better than the economy, but what if we get 10% earnings growth and stocks still remain overvalued? Then you're talking about a 10% jump in the stock market. But then I said, well, what if they're completely wrong, as they tend to be, and we just get the average growth rate of about 6.5% in earnings? Then you're looking at, if valuations remain at overvalued levels, we're talking about maybe a 2 or 3% increase in the market. And then you start asking yourself, you know, if earnings are that disappointing compared to what everybody's projecting, is it likely we're going to see the PE ratio still at 22 times, or is it going to come down? Most likely, what we've seen anytime earnings growth declines is PE ratio comes down. And then that's where you start looking at, you know, what is a more bearish scenario for stocks is, you know, all it takes is a not having 20% earnings growth and investors lowering their PE ratio they're willing to pay. And all of a sudden, we're talking about 5, 10, 15, 20% drops in the stock market for 2017.
I'm not going to wager bet, but I'm betting here in the sense that you would see the latter part of what you just said as more probable than seeing that 20% in earnings, that three times what you'd expect from GDP and inflation.
Yeah, but you know, let me just remind you and all of our listeners that I support a family of six plus, or family kids, six kids and two in-laws, by looking at the data inside the market and not making those type of long-term projections.
Right. No, I realize that. So at Strategic Equity, you know, there's just the ability to continue. If the market continues to do well next year, I'm delighted to see you have those dynamic programs that will capture a significant portion of that. So pretty
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, and that's why we have them. Yeah, that's why we have those in there. And I mean, it's that dynamic aggressive program we have. If we hit that growth rate of 20% for earnings and we see valuations go at 22, I'd argue even if we see 20% earnings growth, we might see valuations go up to maybe 25, 26 times earnings. I mean, we could be looking at one of the best years in this entire century so far that even beats what we saw in 2009. But that's a pretty big stretch. And, you know, just like I'm not willing to bet my family's livelihood on something like that, if I'm an investor, I would not bet that everything goes great for President Trump next year. And that means everything's not going to be great for the stock market. They're literally pricing in a perfect scenario for the economy and for stocks. And that, I don't care who the president is, you know, who's representing us in Congress. It's never going to go out the way the president wants it to go. There's always going to be compromises. There's going to be some surprises. There's going to be things that just they weren't even expecting. And it's the market's just so optimistic right now that always makes me really worried about being disappointed.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's a natural thing. You've seen it numerous times and you've watched it and you lived through it and you've seen the reaction that so many investors have. And, again, this is what you're talking about today, the prospects of what could happen. I appreciate your integrity in sharing that, because it is certainly something that could happen. And some people are saying, it's absolutely going to happen. Well, slow down. But just on the heels of last week, when you brought up, you resurrected the, what's the fellow's name? Warren Buffett's mentor that wrote the Intelligent
Investor. Benjamin Graham. Yep.
Benjamin Graham, right. So, I mean, just the whole concept of value and whatnot. And so it's it does seem that some of those lessons seem to be not being forgotten, but maybe they're just not being, they're falling on deaf ears at this point if we get into this hyper mode. But nevertheless, my take is we're gonna see a lot of volatility. That much I could almost, almost guarantee. Lots of ups, lots of downs, but nevertheless, I remind our listeners that if you haven't explored the merits of active money management, it is absolutely a wonderful strategy. It's not a perfect strategy, but it's one that there's variety of strategies within the whole concept of actively managing and mitigating risk and capturing the upside while also focusing first and foremost to not lose a ton of money. And so that's the aim, you know, can't guarantee anything, but the historical numbers or something you can't count on. But nevertheless, this is the stuff that Jeff eats, sleeps, and breathes every day. I'd remind you if you are, you know, didn't hear the first part where I was mentioning semtradersblog.com. You want to check that out. If you're here locally in Minnesota, we are at the 401k Latte Company, and we absolutely embrace the aspect of active money management, even though, every strategy is not going to be perfect, and neither is every type of buy and hold or every asset class of stock going to do well. So there's always room for ups and downs, but I know there's a lot of people, because I'm one of them, that's, you know, getting into my late 50s, and they're looking at retirement, and it's not this thing that's, you know, 30 years away anymore. And if that realization has hit you, good for you. That's a good realization. And if you're already in retirement, yeah, you should be concerned, depending on how much you're going to have to depend on your assets to generate income. You should absolutely have an emphasis on that. That has to become a top priority, and it warrants a more serious conversation. We'd love to have that with you. In fact, Jeff, there's a tagline we have here at the 401k Latte Company. We like to say,
invest in a conversation.
And do it soon.
You've been listening to What Really Matters with Peter McClellan, a chartered financial consultant with the 401k Latte Company in Lakeville, Minnesota. For a no-cost consultation or second opinion of financial issues, call us at 952-882-0400. That's 952-882-0400. Or visit us online at 401klatte.com. That's 401klatte.com. We want to remind you to invest in a conversation.